As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport podcast on The Athletic. Each week, we'll take you behind the curtain into the world of football business and other sports across the globe. Alongside me today from The Athletic is football news reporter Matt Slater. And we're going to be joined by two of football's leading economic and legal minds, Daniel G and Stefan Szymanski, to help us ponder the question, should football scrap transfer fees? Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for just £3.99 a month, so you'll get all the great analysis, the in-depth features from the very best football writers around, and ad-free versions of all our podcasts. Just head to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman to sign up. Well, let's start with the question of scrapping transfer fees, because this is the piece that you've written, Matt, on The Athletic this week. I just wonder, why now have you written it, and what made you write it?
Well, why now? Well, I wrote it because, mainly because it's the January transfer window, and we are doing a big series of features that are all transfer related, and I thought, well, that's fine. It's good to know every element of that game, which is by far the most popular thing we do. We have a whole podcast dedicated to transfers. I'm just going to sort of, you know, be devil's advocate here, which is interesting because we're about to speak to an advocate, and say, well, why does football have transfer fees? You know, rugby union doesn't. Rugby league sort of did, has sort of got out of the habit of having them now. Cycling was a sport I used to cover, had a famous one that I was one of the first stories I worked on. But, you know, that didn't set a trend. It's very much the one-off. Of course, we know US sport doesn't. Good reasons for that, which we might get into, hopefully. Cricket doesn't. So there's something quite unusual about football, that's the first thing. And then you start to sort of think about that and go, hold on a minute, would I accept a transfer type system in my career? If someone comes calling and wants to offer me a job, would I say, hold on a minute, you've got to pay my current lot quite a lot of money to release me from my contract. I can't come. Oh, sorry, the job's not yours then. And, you know, if you can't come now, then we'll get someone else. I mean, that's a bit odd. So, it got me thinking along all these things. And of course, I'm not the only one that's been thinking along these lines. FIFPro, the World Players Union, have. They've had a go at the transfer system. They backed down and sort of agreed to a kind of negotiated compromise that we are just sort of dealing with the consequences of now. And I imagine that's kind of a sort of a living document that could change again. And then, you know, it was the 25th anniversary of Bosman, which we did on the pod about a month ago, which of course is one of the landmark sporting decisions that really was supposed to, well, many people at the time thought it was the end of the transfer system. It wasn't, as everybody knows. You know, why? So what happened? How did Bosman not release players and give them sort of full control over their careers? So these are the sort of things that were swirling around my head. I stuck it all down. I ended up taking about 1,000 words out because it was becoming a book. But in true Athletic style, people that got to the end of it hopefully realised that it's complicated. And you can pretty much make a good argument for fees or scrapping fees, which is why we've got two of the people I spoke to who had really compelling arguments, one going slightly one way and one going emphatically the other way. And without any further ado, let's get them on.
Let's get them on. We're going to start with Daniel G, leading British sports lawyer, author of Done Deal, the definitive guide to the transfer market's legal framework. Simple one to start with. Where do you stand on this question? Could football do without the transfer market?
Nice, easy one to start me off on, Mark. Thanks. look, I was having quite a lot of thoughts about this over a long period of time, especially over the last few days, which concentrated my mind to a degree. And like anything, it's hard to see what I guess a lot of people in the industry would call the counterfactual, i.e. the situation where something else would occur, bearing in mind that is not the reality and that is not what is happening at the moment. And as Matt said, you know, after Bosman, I think people thought there were going to be quite a lot of fundamental shifts that then led to, you know, reform of the transfer system with all of the stakeholders back at the turn of the millennia, as it was. And then there's been, you know, changes subsequently since. But in true lawyer fashion of not answering or politics, not answering the question at all, the point that I thought about as well, which is a more broader issue, is yes, the football's, I think the football industry could survive without transfer fees. But like what Matt mentioned just before, and this idea, if you can say it right, the specificity of sports, which is not an easy set of a phrase in the first place, is football and other sports. I know we talked about the fact that, you know, some other sports don't have transfer fees. It is special and is different. You know, short, fixed-term contracts, usually over a decade or less. The vast majority of those players on shorter term contracts, not long term contracts. The insecurity of those contracts being pretty prevalent in that one wrong turn, one bad season, and you know, their careers and their contracts and their careers could be over. So I sometimes think that when we talk about the fact that why can't Mbappe move on a free transfer, in a way, that's the headline grabbing differentiator, which is sometimes very different to the actual real market, which is the vast majority of football players globally don't transfer for transfer fees. And I know that where we're talking about the balancing act between contractual stability and free movement, for those elite players that are paid handsomely, I'm not saying they shouldn't be paid handsomely, that is a particular issue impacting a disproportionately small number of players. And I think that context sometimes needs to be seen, because for the vast majority of players, that contractual stability, that requirement that clubs will pay them over a 1, 2, 3 year and or more contract, becomes the very foundation of their careers in what sometimes can be pretty short careers at that.
Does the transfer market protect the value of the minority or the security of the majority? Or a bit of both?
You've definitely put it better than I just explained in the best part of about 6 minutes. Well, it's a great one because of the following. I think that if you take the extreme counterfactual, which is players are just like any other employee, and they may be on big money or not, they may have a very, very specific skill set, which is only valuable for a particular period of time. But that contractual stability also works in the extreme reverse position, which is, okay, let's put it out there that everyone is an employee and can leave on 3 months' notice or whatever the notice period might be under national employment law. Then presumably clubs could necessarily do the same. And what I think then becomes a difficult tightrope, and I know I don't really want to open Pandora's box for everything, but it's an interesting discussion to have, is not only then are FIFPro, I think sometimes, as Matt mentioned, caught in between a rock and a hard place sometimes of wanting to represent all of their members, but also the vast majority of their members not being the elite superstars in that, that actually it could become an even more precarious profession in that shorter term contracts might be extremely lucrative for the very elite players. But for the vast majority of players, if you could simply give 1 month's or 3 month notice on playing for a club and moving elsewhere, I think, maybe I'm looking in too much of an extreme position, I think you know, there's potential questions to ask there on that side.
What do you say to those who say, well, hold on a minute, it's either illegal or it isn't, right? And certainly within the European Union, I know we're no longer in the European Union, but let's pretend that we still are. We've only just got out and football's only just dealing with the ramifications of us leaving. And most of the football industry is still in the European Union. Under EU rules, this is illegal, isn't it? So, I mean, why are you allowed to be elite?
It's difficult to use those type of phrases because I haven't seen a court case that says this is illegal is the truth from a national court or from a European court. Now, the real answer to the question or the probably more nuanced question, and I know it's really to get the reaction, which is the point, is why hasn't a court or European court or national court or European Commission or a competition authority actually made a decision on the legality of the transfer system? I think that's the real question. And I think the answer to that, again, is quite nuanced because at different times, stakeholders, back in your great piece back in 2001, and then more recently as well in 2015, I believe, with FIFPro discussing with FIFA, in the end, the matter didn't go any further. And that is because ultimately, it might not be deemed formal stakeholder collaboration, but it is probably political persuasion and maneuvering, which gets everybody satisfied enough with the potential outcome and solution and a framework in place. So it would take, you know, we go back to Bosman, and you spoke about it brilliantly on a documentary recently as well. We go back to Bosman. It took Bosman, the outlier, the only one that would challenge to actually make that Bosman difference. Now, I'm not saying that there might be another person, Mbappe or otherwise, that would do that. But the issue is also, those at the very top of football, the players, are absolutely disincentivized from challenging the status quo, because although they are potentially restricted from moving, at the same time, the potential issue of challenging the system, putting in place years of legal wrangling, whereas they still need to maximize cynically and practically their earnings, their career, putting that career off track, you can see exactly what it did to Bosman. And it might well be that there aren't enough people, you know, for right or wrong reasons or otherwise, that want to shake that tree the same way.
Yeah, I know, because you tweeted in advance of coming on the podcast that you were doing some research by reading a paper by Jeff Pearson in the European Law Journal. And there's a paragraph near the start.
Oh, dear.
But it's really interesting to read it out, because it broadens it out from just a compensatory debate to actually some of the other things that the transfer market, or how the transfer market is run, throws a few questions in. So I'm just going to read this paragraph, then we can discuss it. So Jeff Pearson says, first, he or she will only be able to move clubs in less than 4 months of any given year. Secondly, he or she will only be able to move with the consent of the current employer, which is unlikely to be given without the desired new club paying a fee, which may amount to tens of millions. Younger players will have significantly less freedom than older players and will be even subject to some restrictions following the conclusion of their employment contract. So in economic terms, it means that elite players will be restricted to moving to a small number of clubs in a handful of EU states, which may exclude their nation of origin. So when you actually broaden it out to it not being just about the financial side of it and a club paying a lot of money to sign someone, there are other technicalities within the market that don't seem, well, particularly fair.
Yes, but I think it's also important to broaden that debate out, if we're going to, into some of the reasons, as Matt's written previously on the transfer window and the reasons for a transfer window, integrity of competition, ensuring stability of competition, making sure that big teams can't buy the players late on in the season, etc., to that advantage. So it should be seen in that slightly wider to context. But I understand that point. The other bit that Matt mentions in the really good article, I think I've plugged it about 17 times now, but keep it. Is talking about, and maybe Matt can talk about it as well, the compensation element for unilateral breach of contract. So I know it sounds quite technical, but what we're actually talking about here is contractual stability, i.e. the players can't move unless the club has effectively materially breached the contract and has a reason to terminate. The issue that's then impacted then is that if there's arguments that says, well, you should be able to just leave, even if you, the club has paid a large transfer fee to you, there have been quite a lot of CAS and FIFA decisions which effectively have hamstrung players that have wanted to try and move by having to then pay back quite large transfer fees by way of compensation. And that, I think, is something that almost certainly needs to be remedied in terms of tighter FIFA legislation, because at the moment, as we've seen with players like Matusalem, De Sanctis, and others, they ended up having to pay back potentially millions of euros in compensation to their former club because of the breach of contract suffered. And that, I think, is a very bad, a poor externality result of the current structure of the transfer system.
Dave, I'm glad you brought up some of those cases. I think if we just sort of tell a little bit of a history here. Yeah. So I think everyone's got their head around Bosman, right? I think we kind of grasp Bosman. There's been enough Bosmans that we understand. If you sit out your contract, you are then a free agent and you can go free. And we know lots of people take advantage of this. Poor old Jean-Marc Bosman, didn't really work out for him, but it certainly worked out for many, many successors. And they tend to get a good wage because the club has saved on a fee. So for those who can wait, wait. And then, of course, what's the reverse of that? Clubs now are very, very nervous about anyone getting into the final 18 months of their contract. So then you get back into the whole contractual stability thing and making sure people don't wind their contracts down. We get that. We've been living with that for 25 years. So how do we get from there to here, where, as you've explained, the pendulum does appear to have swung back towards the clubs, if you like, away from this idea of free agency that people did at the time, though they didn't push it, they didn't go for like the next mile, they did think the whole thing was going to unravel. Various people at the European Commission, important people who were looking at their rule book, the freedom of movement, one of the core principles of the European Union. You and I can go get a job somewhere in Spain. Well, we used to be able to, but that was the point. Now, they didn't go that extra mile. So why didn't? Now, you've mentioned a couple cases there, and I think we could probably handle two. So should we go with Webster? Because I think Webster was interesting. I think Webster came next. Can you give us a minute on the Webster case?
Well, ultimately, very briefly, Webster invoked a pretty nuanced provision in the FIFA regulations, which more or less said that if you provided notice by a certain date at the end of the season, you could effectively move with a degree of what everyone believed smaller compensation to be payable as a result. And in the end, whilst I believe, I'm trying to remember the club, was it Hearts that I think he was?
It was Hearts, yeah. Steve Webster, yeah, defender.
Yeah, exactly. That. So effectively what happened in that first case was that clubs got extremely worried because they believed that actually if the CAS decision was correct and in the end only a small amount of compensation was due for a player who was in contract, effectively breaching his contract, although that's not the right way of saying, providing a notice to be able to leave and get moved somewhere else, that then the idea that transfer fees, large transfer fees would then be payable became more of an issue. And as a result of that, then the Webster case became the first challenge post new transfer regs for clubs to be considering, well, hold on a second, we need to be very careful about this because pendulum swung player side for a time.
So that's interesting. So that's the point I wanted to get to. So Webster takes it that way. I'm going towards the players now. In that it appears that you could give notice and leave, and the compensation would be basically sort of a calculation based on the rest of your contract, basically based on your salary, right? But there would be no kind of transfer element to it, replacement player element to it. So then we get to Matusalem, and the pendulum goes the other way. Explain Matusalem.
Well, very briefly, the circumstances were similar, and it's all to do with this idea of just cause, really, or moving without just cause, and then unilateral termination as a result. And what the decision in Matusalem came, and I think Matusalem ended up being on the hook for over 11...
Yeah, 8 million quid, 11 million euros.
Yeah, exactly. And what the CAS took into account, which they hadn't done, in Webster were things like the non-amortized portion of the remaining transfer fee that would still have been more or less on the club's books, the fees paid to agents and to others, the time left on his contract, and also what's called the protected period, which can be different, obviously, for players over the age of 28 or under the ages of 28. And more or less the pendulum, which was had gone towards the player, swung very much back towards the club, because this was a shot across the bows to say, if you're going to terminate, and if it is done with or without just cause, you, the player, need to be very, very careful about that, because you might be on the hook to it for a huge amount of money. Nothing to do with you, i.e. the fee that was paid to transfer you into the club, but you might be on the hook for it in case you do something that you shouldn't have done.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was, you know, the Brazilian playmaker, play for Shakhtar Donetsk, trying to go to Zaragoza, I think. And that's kind of where we've left it, isn't it, Dane, as far as I could see? I mean, yes, FIFPro a few years ago got very annoyed about the point you were making, kind of undue payables, this idea of lots of their members, not the stars, who are stuck in bad contracts, bad places, not playing, sent to go train with the kids or what have you, basically shamed, you know, into sort of leaving, sometimes aren't just paid. What do you do about them? And then the idea is that FIFA are supposed to sort of be the police here and have this dispute resolution committee that's supposed to sort of solve these situations, but is often just overrun, late, you know, clogged up. And I think this is where FIFA basically lost patience with the system. But then again, back down, which brings us sort of to now where, you know, I think we're just going to get the tweaks that you kind of alluded to, that we're probably going to stay with transfer fees because compensation is something that we can understand. But we do need to protect these players who are being badly treated by bad employers.
The question I think sometimes is, Matt, very briefly, is if the cash jurisprudence changes or the FIFA regulations change to an extent where everybody knows or understands that actually the compensation or whatever else it might be that is going to be payable by the player back to the club goes towards that Webster level, I just wonder whether then transfer fees actually then reduced accordingly, because everyone then becomes aware of what players can do and may do because they're in a stronger position. Now, I just want to caveat one other thing very briefly. In a lot of the player contracts that I see and I negotiate, what clubs will still do is, regardless of the FIFA regulations, they will put in a clause which says if player unilaterally terminates without just cause, and the criteria that we're going to use are the FIFA criteria plus the market value of the player that we believe and will assess at that time as the basis for any compensation claim as a result. So what clubs are now doing is they're adding in extra contractual provisions in order to effectively add in extra factors that aren't necessarily expressly set out in the FIFA regulations too.
But that club in that situation then sets its own market value for that player.
Well, that can be an argument and negotiation point, which is it independent third party? Is it someone that you're using as a benchmarking calculation? Is how much discretion actually is there? And then a lot of the time it comes down to the nuanced position of, when I'm sometimes advising players, it's like, how likely is this to happen? And the answer is not very likely, because those risks are so high, is that sometimes then the player will go, okay, well, I'm just not going to unilaterally terminate my contract under any circumstances. So then I'm not going to have an issue with this if it ever comes up in the first place.
If football was to start again, transfer wise, market wise, would they come up with the system that we have now?
Me or Matt?
No, Daniel, that's got to be for you, mate. You're the guest.
I think that if I was an administrator starting off, and ultimately you want to it's a slightly wider question, because I think what you would then be thinking about is a European versus US model. Do you want a pyramid structure in sport and football more generally, where teams can rise up the ranks? Or do you want a sort of closed, collectively bargained, hermetically sealed system? And I know we're talking about a slightly wider point now, but I think the European model for me works better in terms of my own philosophy. After that, then the question is, if you're not going to have as much collectively bargained situations occurring, and you're effectively allowing the free market to be able to play out for wages and potential transfer fees I agree it's not a straightforward one, but I can see how we've got here. The alternative would be a bit of a tricky one to fuss with.
Isn't it weird, Matt, how so many of our debates and discussions on this podcast over the last, I don't know, how long we've been doing it, 2 months, 3 months, often come back to a European, US model and which works better for whatever subject we're talking about. It is remarkable how many times we come back to that battle.
Those are the two distinct systems for organising professional sport, really. And they both do well in their own ways.
Just a final one, Dan, just about partly going back to the rugby union point and setting the market value. In your experience of working within this transfer market, what's more likely to set a transfer market value? Is it Neymar going for £200 million, euros, whatever, to Paris Saint-Germain? Or is it the players of a Donny van de Beek, for example, going for £34 million or £38 million or whatever it was? Which one sets the market value more?
I actually think there are different markets in the transfer market, if that's the right way of saying it as well, obviously. And at that elite level, I do believe that then those subsequent transfers, you look at Dembele, look at Coutinho, Van Dijk and Alisson, sort of the resulting money flows because of that initial Neymar transfer, many would have considered maybe at an inflated level because of that initial inflated price. The point that you make that I find a fascinating one is sometimes when you're in negotiations, or I'm trying to help in negotiations with agents and players, either on a renegotiation of a contract on its evaluation point as to wages, or assisting clubs in trying to discuss with third-party providers as to how much a player actually is worth in the particular market. There are so many nuanced ways that you can benchmark players these days, and it can be so detailed that you talk about the Van de Beek example. Who knows whether, if he's playing very well for United at the moment, he's pretty good value for money, is the truth, or whether that's actually at an overvalue because they've got 15 number 10s playing in their squad right now. So what I mean there is that it depends on every scenario. Obviously, at the moment, the market is depressed. You can see that with the lack of January activity. The valuation then becomes, again, a self-fulfilling prophecy. And when that money isn't flowing, like it isn't at the moment, and when that money isn't flowing at that top level, like it was doing with Neymar and those other transfers, everything runs in, you know, relative parallels, is I think my short answer.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for joining us. We will talk again soon, I have no doubt about that. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Okay, so we've heard the case for upholding the status quo. We're going to hear now from a man who in 2015 wrote a paper to support FIFPro's argument against transfer fees, the economist and author of Soconomics, Stefan Szymanski. I know, Matt, you want to go first with Stefan.
Well, Stefan, thanks very much for joining us. I have been dying to get you on a podcast for ages, as you know, someone that kind of got into, or certainly got interested in the finance of sport and business of football and what have you, by reading your books, quite frankly. I think a lot of people will be aware of Soconomics, but you've written a few. I'm reading one of your books right now about Detroit. But anyway, enough of the plugs.
Keep going.
No. Come on, we do the plugs. Athletic, right? We shoehorn that in enough. Stefan, we have just heard from Daniel G, who is, as you know, a prominent sports lawyer here in the UK, has written extensively about the transfer market, including a good book called The Done Deal. And he raised, just at the end, I know you've got a lot you want to say, but I just want to sort of finish a point that he was making that I think that you would have a very good insight on as a Brit who lives and works in the States. And he was making this distinction between the European model and the North American sports model, and about how the transfer system kind of works. I know you might disagree, but kind of works in the European model, but couldn't really work in the North American model. There are no transfer fees in US pro sport. Can you explain why there are no transfer fees in North American professional sport?
Well, so firstly, he's not quite right. There are fees that are exchanged in or money changes hands for movement of players. And that has a very long tradition in baseball, which goes back to the 19th century. So I don't know where he gets the idea that there are no exchanges of money. What did happen in baseball, and what has happened in and which is often the model for the US or the other major leagues, is that the commissioner a few decades ago said that cash trades were banned. And so what that meant was that large exchanges of cash for the movement of players were not permitted. And that, although, again, since the commissioner works at the pleasure of the owners of the teams, it's not even clear if that rule is strictly enforceable. If the owners decided that they wanted to make a cash transfer and the commissioner said no, then the owners would ultimately rule the day. So the fact is that they have, in the American system, there have been things like transfers for since the beginning of baseball, and they definitely, and it's not as extensive and it's not as significant as it is in soccer, but there's no reason to say that it couldn't work. And indeed, I've never been able to prove this, but I firmly believe that the origin of the transfer system in soccer, actually in football, comes from baseball, which instituted something called the reserve clause in 1879. And wow. The reserve clause, it looks, as it was originally formulated, looks very, very much like the transfer rules that were adopted in the 1890s in English football. So not only do I think that they have a similar system in the United States, I think actually the origin of the football system comes from North American sports.
Okay, but all right. But by and large, I will take your technical point, but by and large, US sports is a closed system. They share the revenues out. They have a different distribution method for talent. They have a draft system. The deal between the players and the owners is pretty simple. It's a collective bargaining agreement. We're going to make money, all right? But don't worry, you're going to make some money as well. There'll be a ceiling to how much we're going to pay you, a hard salary cap, but there's going to be floors as well. So it is a deal, and of course they get a great big opt out from U.S. competition law with these antitrust laws, and it's basically kind of, people talk about it, a sort of socialism for rich people. That is the sort of shorthand. Whereas over here, it's a bit more of a kind of, away you go, laissez-faire capitalism. I mean, I know you're going to disagree with bits of that, but that is how it is often explained.
No, I've made that argument myself on many occasions. So if we're talking in very broad brush terms, there's this difference between the collectivism of the ownership in North American sports as opposed to the competition amongst teams in the football world, which I think is one thing that makes the football world better. But I think the other point you raised there, which is really fundamental to understanding something like the transfer system is that to the extent that there are transfers between teams in the North American system, and to the extent that cash changes hands, all of this must be agreed with the players through collective bargaining agreements. And indeed, the reason why they are precisely allowed to get away with the kinds of restrictions they have in North America, like salary caps, like the draft rules, these are only permissible because they constitute part of a collective bargaining agreement. And under US law, anything that is agreed within a collective bargaining agreement is exempt from antitrust prosecution, from the competition law. And that's why when the negotiations break down between the unions and the teams in the United States, what happens is the unions try to actually decertify themselves, because that would instantly expose the team owners to antitrust law, and the salary caps would be struck down immediately. So I think the one thing to learn from this story is that if football worked more fairly, if there was a more balanced system, then what it would involve would be a negotiation between representatives of the players to agree a system. And the important point about the transfer system is the players' representatives never agreed to this. This was a stitch-up between FIFA and the European Commission. And that is what is appalling about this. That would never be allowed in the United States. You clearly should have the representation of the players as part of an agreement. That's basic justice, isn't it?
It's interesting, the role of the union then in America, maybe compared to in Europe. I mean, do the players European wide need actually a more powerful union to represent them all in collective agreement?
I would say so. I mean, part of the problem is that, of course, in the United States, it's one country. Okay, I suppose with hockey, you can look at Canada, and that's also relevant. But essentially, the American system runs according to the labor law of the United States. The problem in football has always been you have so many countries involved with such different labor laws and such different political systems, that it would be very hard to have a single union negotiation. And FIFPro, as the international body, has tried to act as a representative, but it's very difficult. And one thing to say is that the treatment of players by country varies quite a lot. I mean, England always in the last half century, it has had a relatively strong union in the form of the PFA. And I think if we're arguing about exploitation of players, then probably England is not your best example. Likewise, in Germany, they've had quite strong representation. So it's not a problem. But as FIFPro has pointed out, in many countries where labor law protections are very weak, particularly in Eastern Europe, for example, there are substantial abuses of players. And people forget that there are, FIFPro says they have something like 60,000 members. We're not talking about the 100 or so players owning more than a million. We're talking about the thousands and thousands of players, many of whom are very young, very experienced, who are being significantly exploited in this system. And that's just a fundamental injustice which goes on every day.
Do you buy into any of the argument that the transfer system can protect players, which is what we've heard on this podcast already?
So, I mean, one thing is I want to be fairly fundamentalist about this. And my assertion is that this is against the law. And no lawyer has ever presented me with an argument to say that, no, this is really legal. And every one of us knows that in our own lives, if we want to leave a job, we're absolutely free to do so. And none of our current employers cannot demand transfer fees. They cannot punish us if we fail to engage in a transfer fee arrangement. I mean, it's sort of as plain as everybody's nose that this is not the law of the land. And we should obey the law of the land. And that should be really the end of the argument, really. Now, what strikes me when I talk to a lot of people about this, and there's an immense amount of denial. And of course, in sports, you see denial about a lot of things. So take another topic like concussion. Concussion, everybody's in denial about concussion in football because it's inconvenient. It's inconvenient to face up to realities about what's going on. And It strikes me that one of the things that people say when they talk about the transfer system, they say, well, oh, forget about the law. Don't worry about the law, but it's useful. It's a good idea. Well, that's completely wrong. You can't just say, no, it's not useful. It's against the law, but it's useful, so we'll have it. That's ridiculous. Now, it is a valid question to ask if the transfer system were to come to an end because it is illegal, then what would happen next? And my view of that is that they footballers would be just like the rest of us, that we have many of us work in jobs where we have contracts with our employers, and many of us enter into a long-term relationship with our employers. And we're not guaranteed by a transfer system. We don't rely on that. We rely on the fact that employers want to build a relationship with us. It's in both our interests. It's in my employer's interest that I'm happy and I work hard and productive for my employer. And it's in my interest that my employer is happy with me and that I'm doing that, and that they see that I'm doing good work. And that's the norm. And that's really the protection that all of us have in our day-to-day jobs. And that's the protection that would be perfectly adequate for most players.
Stefan, allow me to be ridiculous. I'm going to pose some of the defences of the transfer system to you. Right, okay, let's all be normal and footballers can hand in their notice and go play for someone else. Right, well, what about all the clubs at the bottom of the pyramid that depend on transfer fees? Doesn't all that trickle down? Won't clubs go bust without transfer fees?
That's a very popular argument. And I mean, that would be a good argument if the data supported it. But the problem with that argument is there's no real solid data to show that the transfer fees really benefit the lesser clubs. And as you kindly observed in your introduction, I've been writing about this many books, man, many academic articles. I've spent half a lifetime looking at the financial statements of football clubs. So I'm pretty confident that there is no real trickle down going on. And the way to think about this is that the real payoff potential to developing talent and making money in transfers is really like playing the lottery. Small teams draw on talent from their local area. That's basically all that they have available to them. And talent is, fairly evenly spread across the planet. And there's a very small amount of really good football talent. So the chances of you in your little area coming up with such big football talent is like winning the lottery. And winning the lottery and relying on a lottery to ensure financial stability is just absurd. You say, how am I going to ensure that my long-term financial stability? I know, I'll buy lottery tickets every week. That's ridiculous. What you actually want is something more like an insurance system, which is what I've been proposing and suggesting for the last couple of years, actually, is that what football really needs is a system where every team plays in a small percentage of their revenues to an insurance fund, and that when they fall into financial difficulties, they should be entitled under reasonable conditions in order to bail them out, just in the same way that if my house burns down, I can claim on my house insurance, or if my car is stolen, I can claim on my car insurance. Always assuming, of course, that I don't burn the house down myself.
Sure.
Or I don't arrange for my friends to steal my car. All right.
I think, Stefan, I think you've shot down the trickle down, and you've also sort of managed to deal with another one that often comes up is, well, what's the incentive then for developing talent? So I think you've dealt with those. Another one that is often risen as a sort of, oh no, you can't smash the status quo, is this idea of sort of contractual stability and where that meets competitive integrity. So this idea that it would become a free for all, and if you just let people kind of leave mid contract, the league would become a nonsense. What's your response to that?
So, I think I find that just an extraordinary, puzzling suggestion. I mean, we see players moving all the time at very short notice. We see player loans moving between teams within a few months of each other. I mean, we used to have, and it's not that long ago, that we had transfers going on right up to the end of the season. And I mean, we had, that was changed in England when we moved to when we adopted the transfer window system, which is okay. But bear in mind, we had successful football in England for more than a century without that being a problem. So it does seem to me that's a non-starter. We've had this rapid movement of players between teams for a very long time, and it hasn't been a problem. Where I think you could argue is that there might be something to say that a player can't necessarily, if you want to move a few months before the end of the season, then you have to wait until the next season to play. But that's a minor and trivial restriction that you could apply.
If you've dealt with the financial side of the transfer market and the trickle down, as Matt says, would you replace the current system with literally just coming to an end of a contract and moving on, or breaking your contract halfway through? Is that what it then becomes?
Well, I don't know. What's your relationship with your employer, Mark? I mean, I fail to understand.
Which one?
I don't want to get too personal on this yet, so that may be different for you. But most of us who've ever had a job know exactly how this works. It's pretty simple, right? I mean, the mystery. I mean, this is one of the strange things about the strange things about sport in general, is that sport has a tendency to distort our perspective and to make things that are completely familiar seem strange. And the employment relationship is something that almost everybody knows and understands how it works. And what's the problem? You have an employment contract. You work with somebody. And the key thing here is that, I mean, and this is something that people often complain about and fans often complain about, is that teams treat their players like horse meat, as if they were cattle to be traded back and forth. And that there is something of truth in that, and that is a consequence of the transfer system. And what the rest of us expect in our employment relationship is our employer to have an interest in us personally, and for there to be a relationship that develops where there's give and take on both sides. And that's what football clubs would have to do if you abolish the transfer system. They'd have to act like reasonable employers, as every other employer has to behave. It's not complicated.
For any of my employers who are listening to this, my relationship with all of them is absolutely fantastic at the moment. What I'm also intrigued in, I mean, I found the arguments from both Daniel and yourself, pro and against, fascinating. If you were to change it, get rid of it, where are the political battles that need to be won? Who would make the final decision on getting rid of a transfer market? Who needs to be persuaded?
Well, the ultimate decision maker would probably be the European Court of Justice. So we'd be looking at something like the Bosman judgment, which was a judgment of the European Court of Justice back in 1995. And this is probably the major obstacle to FIFPro and people like me who think it should be abolished, which is that you need to get a case taken by the European Court to look at this, which, for one thing, you need to have a player or group of players like Bosman to come step forward and argue the case and claim that the system is at working against them, and for the court to rule against them. Now, the problem is that players are very unlikely to do this. And if any player has explained to them what happened to Jean-Marc Bosman as a consequence of pursuing the case, they're going to be even less likely. I mean, he was basically hounded out of football. And the players who benefited from him, I mean, several people tried to campaign to get some of the players, many of whom were enriched as a result of the Bosman judgment, to get them to give him some money. He ended up penniless and with a number of personal problems, and they tried to get them to give him some money, and nobody would give him any money, which was actually shameful. I mean, it was a disgrace. So I think that's the problem, is that getting someone to step forward and bring a case in court is the real obstacle to getting rid of the system. Although that said, it might well be that as time goes by, I mean, the analogy here in the US seems to be with Colin Kaepernick, and Colin Kaepernick, who stepped forward and was prepared to make a statement about racial injustice in the United States. And again, he's been hounded out of football. I mean, he's not been able to get a job in the NFL, and the owners have squeezed him out. But nonetheless, I mean, he made a stand, and that has had an effect. And that could happen in football in Europe at some point, in which case that the clubs might think that they want to avoid that outcome, and might think that it might even be in their interest to get rid of this sort of, it is an anachronism. It's a very old thing that's really past its sell-by date by quite a long way.
But because you actually mentioned Colin Kaepernick, it gave me another thought as well. Just going back to the freedom of movement thing, that even the American system doesn't guarantee freedom of movement, does it? You can say you might want out, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you will be allowed to leave, just because it isn't a compensatory system in basketball or NFL means clubs just go, oh yeah, you can go, that's no problem. I mean, actually, and the reason it came to mind was I was just thinking of a couple of cases in Houston, one in basketball with James Harden, who has gone to Brooklyn, but I think I'll be dead by the time they next have a first round pick, as far as I can understand from that deal. And the rumors as well are Deshaun Watson wants out of the Houston Texans, but that doesn't necessarily mean in the NFL that he would just go. So you can be restricted within the American system,
right,
too.
Right. So it's not, they don't have complete freedom of movement. And I mean, firstly, American labor law is somewhat different from European and UK labor law. So that's one of the things to bear in mind, is that, in fact, you know, so here's the thing. This gets a little bit technical, but legally speaking, in Europe, if you leave a job, your employer could claim that they are harmed. So, for example, you know, if Matt were to say, "I'm gone, I'm out of here, I got a better offer," then the Athletic might say, "Well, hang on, you were in the middle of preparing something for us, and now we can't do the podcast that we're doing, and this is expensive, and we're going to lose money on this, and so we're going to sue Matt now for damages because he left his job." At which point, actually, that they're going to get nowhere with that in Europe. That's not going to work, because you're fine over there. The court will just dismiss that case and say, no, you're free to move. And in the United States, that isn't necessarily the case. If you leave your job and there is some serious financial harm because of leaving in the middle of a job that was important and now it can't get done, there is some possibility of suing for damages for that, and so that an employer, so the position of an employee wanting to leave is not quite the same. That said, the bigger issue in the United States, I come back to that we discussed before, employment in the NFL and in the major leagues in the United States is subject to collective bargaining. So if a player is restricted, they can complain about that, but then they are union members, and that was a decision of their union, which represented all of them. So they have a democratic voice within the union and say, well, when next time we negotiate CBA, we shouldn't do that. And if all the other players agree, they can agree to negotiate that out of the contract. But they have agreed to it in principle. So in that sense, it's fair. And what's the problem with the transfer system? It's just not fair to force people to obey rules which they never agreed to and which no one else is forced to abide by.
Okay, Stefan, I'm going to be, just as a final thought there, I'm going to be czar for the day. You've won the argument. The transfer fee system is going to be scrapped in European football. But do we not need some sort of transition? I mean, transition phases are all the rage, or have been all the rage here. You've just basically wiped out a load of value off balance sheets of clubs. You've just, you know, their intangible assets are not worth what they were worth, you know, the last time they did their accounts. How are we going to do that? How do we compensate those clubs for the loss of value?
Oh, that is a really great point. And
Sorry, have I saved? Oh, I should have asked this one before. Is it too long?
No. I mean, you're going to have to turn off the microphone at some point because I'm going to go on and on about this for a long time. There is a lot to say about this. So yes, you raise a really important point that the players' contracts are treated as intangible fixed assets on the balance sheets of the teams. This is something that has developed over recent years. This wasn't always true. So up until the 1990s, players were not treated as intangible fixed assets. And if you think about this, the fact that the players can be treated as intangible fixed assets is really quite shocking. You are not. Your employer cannot treat you as an intangible fixed asset. You can treat your cattle as an intangible fixed asset. You can. This is property ownership. And that should tell you that there's a problem with this. Now, the question is, though, what is the significance of these intangible fixed assets? Well, clearly, the idea behind one of the ideas is to spread the cost of the player transfer fees over a number of years, which is actually makes a good deal of sense in terms of how you represent the finances of the club. So it's a kind of a smoothing thing. But then the other point about this is by representing these things as assets, you can go to a bank and say, will you lend me money, please? Because I've got assets here and you could lend me money against these assets. And in principle, you could think of this as being a mechanism for enabling the clubs to finance themselves. However, if you look at the balance sheets of the clubs, as I do, you will see that there is virtually no bank debt on the books of the clubs. There is virtually no commercial debt on the balance sheets of these clubs because no bank or commercial lender in their right mind is going to lend to a football club because these are hopeless investments and always have been. So in that sense, if they were borrowing commercially from banks and you took away these intangible fixed assets, it would potentially be a problem. But since in almost all cases the banks are not lending to these businesses, it really doesn't matter that much. Now, to sort of square the circle, the financing of clubs actually comes from the wealthy individuals who own them in most of the cases. Most clubs are underwritten by soft loans by people who own the team. So in that sense, you know, these have become playthings of the rich. And so taking away these intangible... I'm not against a transition period, fine, you know, as long as it's not too long. But actually, it's not really a problem.
Thank you very much for coming on. It's been absolutely fascinating, Stefan, and we appreciate you giving us your time. Thank you
very much for having me.
All the best.
Thank you.
Cheers.
That's it. Thanks very much for listening. I'm back on Monday with David Ornstein. See you then. Bye.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.